Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. Do you know what the most common reason for hospitalization in the United States is? You're thinking orthopedic surgery, joint replacement, cardiac surgery. None of those. It's care of childbearing women and their newborns. The United States spends more on maternity care than any other country, but ranks lower than at least 30 other countries on maternal mortality, neonatal mortality, low birth weight, and exclusive breastfeeding. Cesarean section is now used for one in every three births, and induction, or medically induced labor, is all too common. Well, so what? Well, we know the poor pregnancy outcomes can have lifelong consequences for mothers and their babies, including being associated with chronic illnesses like asthma, heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. So why aren't we doing a better job on maternity care? A recent study by the American College of Nurse Midwives suggests that it's because women aren't fully informed and engaged in making decisions about their care before, during, and after the birth. These findings coincide with two national initiatives to improve the quality of maternity care through shared decision-making with women so they can make informed choices about their prenatal care, their births, and care of their newborn. I'm really pleased to have on Health Styles today two people who will discuss this work with us. Let me first introduce Tina Johnson. She's the Director of Professional Practice and Health Policy for the American College of Nurse Midwives. Tina, welcome to Health Styles.
Hi, Diana. Thank you for having us.
Tina, are you a midwife?
Yes, I am. I've been a certified nurse midwife since 2000, and I still work in inner city Baltimore at a community hospital, and I enjoy it very much, in addition to my role at ACNM.
Great. And we also have Amy Romano, who's the Associate Director of Programs for Childbirth Connection, and she's Project Director for Transforming Maternity Care Partnership that we'll hear more about a little bit later. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Diana.
So, Tina Johnson, let me start with you. The American College of Nurse Midwives recently reported on a national survey of women about their conversations with their healthcare providers about their pregnancy and birth. Tell us what some of the key findings of this survey were.
Sure. Okay, so the survey was done this summer in August. It was completed by 1,252 women between the ages of 18 and 45, women from a variety of cultural backgrounds from across the United States. So we really wanted to get a look at a broad spectrum of women during those childbearing years. And we were really looking for what women wanted to know about their care and what they were getting and what kinds of conversations they were having. And just in terms of some of the findings, the large majority of women, about 85%, said that they are somewhat to very satisfied with their care, yet most say that they are not getting many of the services that they want. For example, they expect to receive annual pap smear exams and breast exams from their women's health care providers, but most women are looking for services beyond these. Many women would like a provider who offers family planning advice after a previous birth, for example, but only 13% received this information. Women wanted to know about a range of pain medication options and pain management options during childbirth. But only 29% say they received this information from their health care provider. In addition, women wanted to be provided with a choice of birth setting, at least half of the women, but only 23% said that they received that information. So what we really took away from this is that women are not having the important conversations with their health care providers that they should be having.
So
go ahead.
Well, let me just ask you, one of the startling findings to me was that in terms of breastfeeding, that only 26%, I think, said that they were having conversations about breastfeeding with their provider.
Right. Even with the overwhelming benefits of breastfeeding for both moms and babies, about 3 out of 4 women did not talk with a healthcare provider about breastfeeding during their pregnancy, which we know is the key time to discuss these issues with women so that they can then be thinking about it and planning for it so that they can successfully breastfeed after they deliver their baby. And the other interesting finding is that most women say they would like guidance on and information on family planning options after a previous birth, but 80% of women did not discuss this issue at all with their provider. So it's really sort of interesting, the differences what we're finding between what women want and say that they would like to have and what they're actually getting.
I find some of these findings were shocking to me. Another one was that I think the so many women saying that they would have an induction, that they didn't seem to understand, even if it wasn't medically necessary.
Right. 9 out of 10 women would not mind a labor induction, even if there's no medical reason.
So why should one mind being inducted?
Well, because an induction of labor is not the optimal course. We know that labor progresses best and birth outcomes are most effectively accomplished if women are able to go into spontaneous labor and birth in a normal physiologic way. Any time that you have to administer in medications or other procedures to sort of jumpstart that process, you know, you're working against the body's normal mechanisms, and it takes longer and it has inherent risks, many of which are sort of that the cascade of interventions that happen. Once you introduce one intervention, it often leads to more interventions and culminates, unfortunately, in what we've seen with the numbers in unnecessary cesarean birth, and it sets women up for future problems during future pregnancies, which is largely what's contributing to our rates of maternal mortality and morbidity in this country, which, as you mentioned, are just unacceptable.
So if I get induced, if my labor is induced, am I more likely to have a cesarean section?
Yes, you're more likely to have a cesarean section. You're more likely to need higher levels of pain management, such as epidural. You may or may not need additional assistance, such as vacuum or forceps delivery. And so it's just really not the best option. Optimally, labor will start on its own. And, of course, if someone has a medical complication, that's a different story. But we're talking about elective induction, especially elective induction that's happening too soon, which we've seen as a big problem in this country. We know that there's a national movement to eliminate elective induction of labor before 39 weeks. And actually, many of us in the healthcare world would like to see that, you know, up to 40 and 41 weeks. We would like to see women be able to have the information to allow their pregnancies to start on their own, their deliveries to start on their own, as opposed to, you know, with the use of medication and intervention.
I was also stunned that 41% said they wouldn't mind having a cesarean section that was not medically necessary. I don't understand that one.
Yeah. Actually, that statistic, it was actually nearly 60% of women who would have a cesarean section that was not medically necessary. So even more shocking, a statistic that, you know, we were really surprised to find out. So what that really led us to is that women just really don't, I don't think, understand the range of the options that are available to them. They're not getting the information that they need. And in this day and age, with so many options out there for everyone in choosing health care for their lifespan, we realize the importance of engagement with providers to really try to get to the heart of what is best for people so that they can make those informed decisions for themselves. But you can't make a decision if you're not informed because no one has discussed things with you. So we really feel like this is something we need to work on.
Now, Amy Romano, Childbirth Connections has been for a number of years, been looking at women's experiences with childbirthing. You have a series of surveys that have been conducted called Listening to Mothers. Do the findings of your surveys coincide with what the survey by the American College of Nurse Midwives found?
Yeah, absolutely. We've done listening to mother surveys for two times now. The most recent was of women who gave birth in U.S. hospitals in 2005, and these are nationally representative surveys that ask a number of questions about women's childbearing experiences, their thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors about childbirth, and what kind of care they actually received. And although we didn't ask the exact same questions as the American College of Nurse Midwives did, the findings don't surprise me at all of what ACNM found. We found very high rates of interventions in terms of tests and procedures during labor, and of course, the, you know, surgical intervention in terms of C-section and episiotomy as well, despite most women agreeing with statements that labor and birth are normal biological processes that shouldn't be intervened with unless there's a medical reason. We also asked about women's actual knowledge of really basic potential risks of common interventions, including C-section, induction of labor, and epidural. And these weren't, you know, trick questions. They were really basic questions that anybody that, you know, would consider or have a conversation about consenting to those should know how to answer. And we found that the most common response from women was that they didn't know the answer, and that women were just as likely, if they did answer, to answer incorrectly as correctly. And in fact, when we looked closer at that data to look at women who actually underwent those interventions, whether it was induction or C-section, they were no more likely to answer correctly than women who hadn't. So so these are data that are familiar to us. We're in the process now of data collection for our next Listening to Mother survey. That data will be out in the early part of 2013. And we've also done some focus groups on with women around questions of induction of labor and C-section, and again, find sort of the same problem where women have pretty casual attitudes about these interventions, even though they say they want to know what the potential risks are. They don't when you query them. And we also, through our focus group research, got really more of a picture of what these conversations with the clinicians look like. And what it seems is that they're just really, women are not given an opportunity to explore, you know, what are their options, what are their alternatives, what's in it for them if they wait for labor, what's in it for them if they induce, you know, how they can bring their own values and preferences into these decisions, and how they can use the actual medical evidence and clinical expertise to guide them to the right answer too. So, we're just seeing that there, we could be doing a much better job informing women and preparing them for these decisions.
Well, in fact, what I'm hearing from my nurse colleagues, as well as what I hear from young women themselves, is they want the first thing they ask for when they go to deliver is where's the epidural. So the epidural seems to be an in thing. It seems to be a thing that women, young women, are wanting. I'm wondering if there's any evidence that that's on the rise. And my other question is, why shouldn't they have an epidural? What's the problem with an epidural? Tina, do you want to take a first stab at that?
Well, the epidural rates in this country have increasingly gone up over the years. And, you know, there is a range of options that people can use to help them cope with labor. Things that we've known and done for years as midwives, for example, such as position changes, you know, back massage, all kinds of guided relaxation exercises. There are even other alternatives to epidural that do involve medication. One of the sort of newer on the U.S. horizon is nitrous oxide usage, which has been more popular overseas in other countries but is now gaining sort of a foothold here in the U.S. And in addition, you know, IV pain management that's sort of more short-term can be utilized. There are a lot of other options that are available to women. And unfortunately, like you said, the one everyone hears about is epidural, and it is just sort of taken over as sort of the main mainstream way of managing labor. But there are many reasons not to use epidural. There are many women aren't able to experience sensations to bear down and push their babies out.
Maybe explain what an epidural is before you get into what they'll experience. It will make more sense, I think, to some listeners who, and I apologize for not explaining what epidural was to begin with.
That's okay. The epidural is medication that's injected into the epidural space, which is, you know, accessed at, in a woman's back, that basically renders a woman numb or unable to move or experience sensation, usually below the level of the waist. And so, you know, they don't necessarily experience the intensity of the contractions that they would if they were laboring on their own. However, you know, there are risks with epidural, including that one of the most common is that it just doesn't work very well, or it only works on one side. Women have sort of intermittent relief with it. Anything from not working so well all the way up to, you know, anaphylaxis that can occur, you know, an allergic reaction to the medication that can cause very severe consequences, including even death of the mother, which is very rare. But again, that is a complication. And it should be explained in a way so that women can understand that if they choose this, in the vast majority of cases, it's perfectly fine and safe, but it does have consequences. It also has consequences for the fetus, the baby, because, you know, it often will cause a drop in the mother's blood pressure, which then will cause decelerations of the fetal heart. Sometimes the baby takes a while to recover. Sometimes the baby doesn't recover very well, and the woman needs, you know, additional measures, including a cesarean, if the baby doesn't recover fully. So there are consequences potentially for the baby, although, again, it's usually, if it's done properly, it's very safe. Still, a woman needs to have the knowledge so that she can make the choice for herself. Conversely, things like, you know, moving about in labor and massage and hydrotherapy, laboring in a warm water tub, those are all evidence-based, you know, pain management techniques that don't cause those consequences for the mother and baby. So it may be still that at the end of the day, that's what she wants and that's what she's certainly able to get, no matter who her provider is. But, you know, they need choices and they need the information so that they can best make those decisions. And they need it ahead of time. They don't, you know, it's very difficult to explain all the risks and complicated benefits of everything at the last minute. Women really need to be having these conversations during their pregnancies, even beforehand, be thinking about what their ideal options are.
And that was Tina Johnson, Director of Professional Practice and Health Policy for the American College of Nurse Midwives. We're also talking with Amy Romano, Associate Director of Programs for Childbirth Connection, and we're talking about childbirthing in the United States and some recent findings that suggest that women are not fully informed about the options that they have prenatally and during the birth and after the birth. And certainly this has been an issue that Childbirth Connection has been trying to address, Amy. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your effort around evidence-based maternity care and trying to foster a better understanding that we do know what best practices are. We have a lot of evidence, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the field of obstetrics was really the field that got the evidence-based practice push started in the United States. It was recognized pretty early on that obstetrics was really more of a you know, kind of individualized, different doctors practice different ways, and that nobody was really following the evidence. And so there was a concerted effort a few decades ago to start generating better obstetric evidence. And now we're actually ahead of most other specialties in terms of what we know works and doesn't work. But we also, you know, certainly have some gaps in that knowledge. And one thing, getting to the issue of epidurals, is that most of our research on epidurals is really comparing epidurals with IV medications, so things like narcotic or opioid medications that take the edge off and that are in the bloodstream and can make women feel really woozy and out of it, and they're not very effective for many women, and it really alters the birth experience in a different way. And so it's pretty understandable that women prefer the more complete anesthesia, if you will, more complete pain relief, and also a sense that she's kind of in control. She hasn't, you know, lost her faculties or feel like, you know, nauseous or some of those other side effects. So I But if you compare an epidural to some of the other strategies that Tina was talking about, which, again, nobody has done in the research, but any of us who've practiced midwifery or been around birth know that, that women are fully capable of getting through labor without an epidural. And really, most women who've been through that, especially if they do it because that was their plan as opposed to because, you know, they couldn't get the epidural in time or somebody told them they couldn't have it. But a woman who, you know, really is informed, thinks about her options, thinks, you know, I want to do this without pain medication and then is able to do that, they really value that experience and they really look back very fondly on their birth and feel extremely empowered by that. And often they carry that sense of empowerment to other things they do. And what an important time to help a woman feel that kind of empowerment when they're embarking on this journey of motherhood, right? So I think we can answer certain questions with evidence, but we still need to acknowledge the uncertainties and acknowledge that, you know, evidence is one piece of it, and women's values, concerns, preferences, culture is another piece of it. And there's some interesting research around epidurals that it doesn't really impact your chance of your preference going into labor about whether you want an epidural or want to avoid an epidural is actually not a very good predictor of whether you're going to have an epidural. And so what that says to me and other people who have looked at this issue is that hospitals aren't really offering women alternatives or aren't supporting alternatives in the same way that they support epidural and sort of that very medical approach. And epidurals really alter the birth experience, but for many women who are experiencing these very significant interventions in their birth in the first place, you know, with so many women being induced, and then those who aren't induced, so many of them are having drugs and procedures to speed up labor or slow down labor. They're kept in bed. They can't eat. They can't drink. And none of these are really supported by evidence for the, you know, the healthy, low-risk women, which most women who are giving birth are healthy and low-risk, and yet they're subjected to all of these interventions and don't have access to the supportive care and just the sense that they can do it without it. So I don't blame really any woman for making that choice in the midst of that.
Good point. We're almost out of time, and so I want to have each of you just take a quick minute to talk about how your websites have incredible resources on them. Amy, give a quick summary of what's available at your website and what the website is.
Sure. Well, Childbirth Connection has a lot of resources at www.childbirthconnection.org. And really for each topic, whether it's induction or C-section or pain relief, we have one section that just looks clearly at the evidence and says what do the best quality research studies say. And then we offer additional information in the form of different tips, tools, and resources to follow on that evidence-based information. And currently we're partnering with the Informed Medical Decisions Foundation actually to develop some much more interactive, including video and all kinds of other features, tools to bring the evidence together with women's informed preferences and values and develop these evidence-based decision support tools for the range of options as well. So that'll be coming. It's not there quite yet, but people can find a lot.
And that was childbirthconnection.org. And Tina Johnson from the Association of the College of Nurse Midwives, the American College of Nurse Midwives, tell us about your website, Our Moment of Truth.
Right. Our website, we have launched a new initiative to help encourage women to become active participants in their health care and learn more about the full range of options available for their needs. And also prompting them to find providers who can meet their unique healthcare preferences instead of settling on the type of care that they're used to receiving. And also to reintroduce midwifery care as an important option that should be widely considered and that we feel should be the norm for U.S. women. This is www.ourmomentoftruth.com. We have lots of tools on this site available to help women renew their commitment to their health. We talk about the survey findings. There's all kinds of true or false questions sort of designed to see what women think they know, and sometimes they'll be surprised to learn that the answers may be different than what they thought. And also to tell the truth about the the high-quality professional services that midwives offer beyond maternity care as well. You know, feeling like that there's a major, this major gap between what women say they want and out of care during pregnancy and childbirth and what they really are receiving. And so this website, like I said, contains lots of tools for the consumer to really to sort of help them get started in thinking about what they want and how to evaluate that. And, you know, you can also read real stories. You can read the mission of the movement. You share your own story about your childbirth. Read other folks' stories about what it has meant to them to really finally have an experience, the birth experience that they so want.
And that's www.ourmomentoftruth.com. Well, Tina Johnson from the American College of Nurse Midwives, thank you so much for joining us on Health Styles today. And Amy Romano from Childbirth Connection, I want to thank you as well. You're both doing very important work. And I hope that our listeners, if you're not pregnant or planning on getting pregnant or can't get pregnant, you might think about those whom you know who are contemplating pregnancy or are pregnant and encourage them to go to these websites and to look at making informed choices about their prenatal care, the birth, and care of themselves and their babies afterward. Thank you for listening to Health Styles. Health Styles is brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. You can follow us on our blog at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program. Thanks for tuning in.